Dr. Anas Nader is a doctor by background and the CEO and co-founder of Patchwork Health, an end-to-end workforce solution which helps health systems tackle the staffing crisis. They've raised over $30 million to date. Anas is really interesting and candid, and we talk about why the Patchwork team is bigger than WhatsApp's. We talk about how to get your product into healthcare systems, and we also talk about key decision-making frameworks he's learned along the way. I hope you enjoy. I've been following the tech layoffs a lot, and there was this article that came out saying that while some tech firms have thousands and thousands of employees, WhatsApp, which is a $19 billion business, only has 55 employees. And then I was looking over your website and I saw a picture of your whole team, and I think it looked like over 60 people. And I just wanted to ask you, for someone who's never ran a business, can you explain to me why an organization like Patchwork, why you end up needing so many people? Because it's like difficult to comprehend why, you know, 5 or 10 people in a garage can't do this. But that's probably from my own ignorance rather than anything. But yeah, can you explain why you need so many people?
That's a great question. I love this question. All right, let's just divide my answer into two parts. There is the first part, which is different kind of businesses, why they need different kind of people and different sizes. And the second question about generally a point about careful not to overhire and be very careful how you build your teams and the important message to founders there. Let me start with the first point. The reason why certain teams like WhatsApp can be much smaller teams than companies like Patchwork and others in our space might be bigger teams is twofold. The first one is, what are you offering? So WhatsApp is a single point of value. They offer a messaging platform that currently, by the way, is heavily, as a concept, is heavily commoditized. So many companies, I mean, like Patchwork is doing as well, are incorporating messaging into their platforms as just a feature, not a product. WhatsApp is messaging as a product. You know, a lot of companies now just have messaging as just something that happens on the side. So the technology around end-to-end encrypted messaging is not that complex anymore. It's been commoditized and, as I said, introduced just as a, right now, what you and I are using has a side messaging chat. That's pretty much found in every product in the world, or most products. What WhatsApp has to have is maintain the scale of amount of messages and ensure security and ensure they're able to protect themselves from bad actors. Now, mind you, I think that quote you're talking about is the size of the engineering team, because since they've been absorbed by Facebook, now Meta, they had to also add other kind of layers of compliance teams and ensuring that there's content moderation. That's a whole different issue. But the engineering team really fundamentally, if you think about the value proposition of their product, is pretty straightforward from that point of view. It's a single point of value, and it's about maintaining it securely at scale. That's the first difference, whereas we are not a single point of value. The surface area that our products cover are huge. So, and when you serve an enterprise, unlike a B2C consumer product, when you serve an enterprise, you are, and then you're owning a value chain. Like in our world is workforce. So we didn't talk about the evolution of product earlier, but you know, we started off with temporary staffing. Right now we do temporary staffing for bank, collaborative bank, we manage a bit of agency, and we now do rostering, which manages substantive clinicians, full-time clinicians. So we now are a multi-product enterprise platform, which basically means the product surface area is quite large. And that's quite normal, because enterprises like hospitals in the NHS don't want to buy 100 different apps, each doing one single thing. They don't want 100 single points of value in 100 different apps. They want a single platform that owns a certain vertical. So EPRs, electronic health records, they want to own the entirety of that. PAS system, entirety of that. Radiology systems, the entirety of that, from booking to scanning to reporting to discharging. Workforce, my point of view, that's what we do. The entirety of workforce, whether it's recruitment to onboarding to rostering permanent staff to filling vacant bank shifts to cascading to collab banks to managing timesheeting and payroll. And that means you're covering a large surface area. And that means naturally the size of your team will have to be bigger than a tech team that is building a single point of value focused on one thing. I envy sometimes some of that, but it's just the world we're in. We're not in a B2C world, we're in an enterprise world. That's the first reason why our team is bigger. The second reason is WhatsApp does not have sales and marketing teams. When you download WhatsApp, you didn't have a call with a sales person who's done a demo for you and then sent you a contract and then you signed a 5-year contract. You just you heard it word of mouth, you download. They probably have marketing teams that do product growth marketing and that kind of thing, but they don't have enterprise sales teams. And more importantly, and that's a big part of our team that makes our team the size it is the implementation and customer care team. Because enterprises don't just go in and go on your website, put their credit card number and buy the product, right? Enterprises go through a sales process. And once you've actually managed to go through that journey and a procurement process, potentially a tender process, once you've landed the contract, now you have an implementation and a configuration and training the teams. And then you go live and you have ongoing customer care. These are large contracts with large organizations. So teams like companies like ours doing what we do, and we're not unique in that, will naturally have larger teams and larger size teams than companies that have that single point of value for B2Cs. So that's kind of my first half of my answer. That explains a little bit why our team is not like WhatsApp. But the other point, and I think that's a very valid point to talk about in this cycle of technology evolution with the macroeconomics, with the layoffs, is in the last 10 years, because money was cheap for a lot of startups, raising money was cheap and easy. And when you raise a lot of money, you need to justify to your VCs why you raise that money. So you start burning through cash faster. And the fastest way to burn through cash is over hire, way more than you need. And if you run out of cash, there's more cash out there. So you hire more cash. And there's somehow, for some reason, incentives have been skewed and egos have been measured by the size of your teams and rather than the growth and the value you're adding to the world. And I think a lot of companies who've done that have been faced by the reality of 2022 and the tech bubble starting to burst right now. And all that cheap money that resulted in hyper bliss scaling that wasn't sustainable and wasn't really necessary in a way. Are they all now going through those massive tech layoffs? And I say this because it's really important. Now, of course, let's be clear. There are some businesses who have hired for the right reasons and with the right size, but the economic situation just turned against them. And this is the world of business. Sometimes that happens and you therefore have to go downsizing teams, sometimes even going bankrupt. And that's a whole different story. And these are, you know, they're all legitimately good sized team and probably were appropriately sized, but then the market just turned on them and it happens every 10 years where we go through these corrections and there would be some collateral damage along the way. But I'm talking about the teams that actually shouldn't really have grown that fast, shouldn't really have spent all that, you know, cheap VC money to grow their team simply for growing them without actually being purposeful in what you're doing, what you're hiring, what's your org chart, what's the purpose of every new joiner? Are you creating value or are you bloating the system? And it's really important for entrepreneurs and founders and management teams to challenge themselves on that point and be very careful with this because A, these are people's lives you're dealing with. You know, hiring is, and then having to downsize after that, you're kind of putting people through a very stressful part of their careers and their jobs. And secondly, bloating the company beyond your actual true need results in just grinding the business into a slow moving Titanic. Because now you have more people, more nodes of communications, more layers of management. And all of that just comes in the way of actually getting stuff done. So, you know, I remind myself, remind my team, and I remind people to just always be very purposeful in every new hire you bring in. A, so you don't end up running into a problem where you run out of cash because you're overhired, which is what we're seeing now. But also, it's just counterintuitive to growth. It actually doesn't necessarily mean you'll go faster. And sometimes it actually means you go slower. So that's my feedback on that point. But of course, comparing an enterprise SaaS company to WhatsApp is also the other point to mention there.
If you had to distill down a lesson or two from dealing with hospital systems in terms of getting contracts with them or keeping those relationships going well, what have you learned there essentially? Like, what is it about, like, greasing the right palms, putting a tenner in someone's pocket, or like, what's God, the secret no. there?
God, no, that should never be the case. working with healthcare is really about ensuring that you're able to communicate the value and able to support the reduction of cost of change. Because really the biggest barrier to adopting new solutions and technology is the hesitation to go through an expensive process of either replacing an incumbent or bringing you into a world that they didn't have. And the cost of change tends to be the area that most people just do not want to go through. And of course, there's, you know, a lot of often bad implementations or historic IT projects that just left bad taste with a lot of clinicians and management in hospitals, that they just after 24 weeks, just here's another platform coming in, here's another tech being sold to me, and you know what, I'd rather stick to my Excel sheets, it's just easier. So it's really about overcoming that barrier and communicating the value and also your commitment to owning that cost of change. And that's why we own the implementation, that's why we built incredible customer success and customer care teams, because really we want to take away that friction and say, listen, we'll do the heavy lifting of changing over, we'll do the heavy lifting of moving you into the new world. So that's not a barrier to the conversation. The second one is about building a reputation of being a reliable partner to your NHS customers. Because fundamentally, you know, the NHS is a small world. There's only about, 240-250 NHS trusts, if you include mental health, ambulance, and acute trusts, and 42 ICSs in England, and the rest of our health boards in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales. That's actually a small world in the grand scheme of things. And your reputation becomes your biggest thing. And often we find that when sometimes we go into a conversation with a new organization, what really helps smoothen things, if suddenly someone in that organization is like, oh yeah, I know these guys. When I used to work with my other trust, we used them, and they were just great. The tech was great, but also their support was excellent. When things went wrong, they fixed it fast. They were always responsive. They looked after us. Once actually we go to a trust, we find someone who says that, it just makes our life 10 times easier, because you got all the social proof that you need to kill the noise from the signal and really amplify what you're trying to communicate. So, and that's why it's usually the hardest getting the first few use cases. If you get the first few use cases and you land the right reputation, then that actually makes your life easier, because the NHS loves tried and tested with good reputation. So fundamentally, it's about that. It's about really good value communication, good ability to assure that you're able to do the heavy lifting, because people hate change management, and just building a reputation and, you know, doing everything you can to protect it.
I like asking smart people who are building cool stuff in healthcare, you know, if you had more time or you weren't working on this, what would you be working on? And, you know, are there any cool opportunities you see? Are there any big open goal businesses in kind of the healthcare region that you think would be interesting? Like, what would you be working on if not this?
Ooh, interesting. I think there's a lot of players now working in the space of home-based care. And I think there is still a lot to be done there. It feels like we're getting some movement in either home diagnostics or home tests or home monitoring, but I'm yet to see something that is end-to-end connected truly to the heart of healthcare and connected to the heart of hospital and GP systems. So there is a genuine, as soon as you walk to the hospital, everyone knows who you are. You don't have to go through repeating 10 times your story to the first nurse, the next nurse, the first doctor, the next doctor. That information is connected. But, you know, a lot of people talk about that being just a hospital and GP information, but actually your wearables, your home diagnostics, your home care. So a truly connected home-based, community-based, and then hospital/primary care-based care is a space that I feel there's, you know, a lot to be done there. The challenge is there isn't necessarily a very obvious way to make it into a commercial success, because the money doesn't flow there. The money flows in, at the moment, still in transactional-based care. It's not value-based care as much as can be. It's not outcomes-based population health care. ICSs are hopefully bringing that promise, but until there is the commercial incentive for innovators to go into that space, unfortunately, I don't think it's very obvious for people to move there yet. So people are focusing primarily on that single point of value of like a bit of home diagnostics, home monitoring, home testing, but to connect it all together and orchestrate it is definitely a space in healthcare that's missing. That's my healthcare, the other healthcare thing that I think someone hopefully should go after. I've got a lot still to do within workforce, but actually outside of healthcare, I actually think the art industry, my wife is a fine artist. And that is an industry that is completely stuck in very old days with a lot of entrenched interest to make it very analog and opaque. And I think artists are getting the short end of that stick. So I actually think there's a lot of disruption to be happening in that space, but that's maybe future me might look into that one day. Who knows? Or someone hopefully should look into that, because I think that space should massively be disrupted.
Are there any habits or ways you approach problems that have been helpful for you in your career?
I'll tell you one that I've learned in the last couple of years. When you're faced with a problem, I used to quickly try and jump solutionize it. And I realized that very rarely do you need to have the answer right away. And I've learned that actually taking space away from the problem, as immediate and urgent it is, very rarely is that urgent, where you cannot say, let's all absorb the information and walk out. And for me, that means literally leaving the building, leaving the space I'm in into a different environment. It could be a walk, it could be a cycle, it could be a swim, it could be whatever physical activity. I do find physical activity a good way for me to think about solving a problem and come back to it next day. Because usually when you're trying to solutionize in the immediate here and now, as soon as the problem is presented to you and it feels so urgent, and you just ask everyone to drop tools and come and huddle and let's solve that problem, you're probably running on adrenaline. You probably don't have all the facts yet. You probably haven't reflected on all the unintended consequences of your solution. And you're probably, especially as a CEO and lead of the team, you probably might stress people around you as well, who feel that they have to also respond to it urgently, when actually taking a bit of a breather and stepping away from it is the best technique. So I'm one thing I definitely found so much better for decision making is take space from the problem and come back at it. You can still do it within 24 hours. And you often find you're coming at a more holistic way of thinking about the problem and the solution itself. And your team probably has some time as well to think with you. So yeah, that's one tip that I think has worked for me and has certainly helped improve decision making.
That's really interesting. I was at a meeting of some surgeons who were discussing a mistake that had been made. And essentially, when they were doing the post-mortem in terms of what decisions were made and how they would change it, I think they'd opened up and realized that the actual cancer looked different to what it had previously been thought of in the scans or the pre-op work. And the surgeon who was leading it said that he'd wished he'd just taken time to, instead of trying to make a decision there and then with the patient open, he'd just taken time to step outside, have tea for 15 minutes and then come back and think through things. And it was, in fact, trying to go through things too quickly that it caused that. So super interesting that that's your kind of learning as well.
Oh, wow. That's a great example. And I've been in so many operating rooms where you feel that, you know, because there are operations that go for like 24 hours. So actually, you know, if the patient is stable on the table, you actually can afford to take a 15-minute break, step out and think about it before you can, and you don't have to, whilst the sharp knife in your hands, to make a decision then and there. That's fascinating. I completely get that. It's interesting that came up there. And that's very good reflection point from that surgeon.
Do you have any book, resource, podcast, etc. recommendations, stuff that you found useful for you in your in building Patchwork?
Honestly, there isn't a single one. There's a few of them that I'd recommend. I mean, my most recent favorite book is 4,000 Weekends, but that's more about understanding your relationship with time and the our mortality and how we want to make the most out of the lives we have, the short lives we have. I read a lot of books, both fiction and nonfiction. I think the one that I always recommend is The Hard Things About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. It's a great book for founders, CEOs. There's a few more that are going to that genre, like the Lean Startup, Crossing the Chasm. But honestly, what I would almost always caveat is these books are really good at inspiring people to think differently, to learn from people's other experiences. But I'd caution from ever looking at them as, you know, the Bible of something, right? Or the playbook for all the problems. Because fundamentally, no two companies or no two businesses and no two startups and no two founders are the same. So draw inspiration from others. And there's quite a few podcasts I listen to. So I do listen to A16Z, 20 Minute VC, there's a few more like that that I, you know, I listen to the our tech-based podcasts. I can't remember all of them. And they're all great, by the way, because they bring amazing tech leaders and startup, you know, journeys that we can all learn from. But I think very importantly, assimilate all that information, but find your own path, find your own playbook, because each company has its own playbook, has its own story, has its own journey. Each founder has their own strengths and weaknesses. I would say more important than books and podcasts is as early as possible in your journey. And that's one thing I wish I did earlier, is get an executive coach, someone who can be a trusted individual where you can be vulnerable and open about the challenges, but they can actually hold you accountable as well to the things that you are trying to improve on and provide you the honest feedback from the sidelines. Because unlike your co-founder or your investors or your life partner, they're all got vested interests in your success or fear of your failure. You can be honest and open with them. It's very important to have a healthy, transparent relationship with all these stakeholders, investors, founders, clients, colleagues, employees, your partner. Fundamentally, there's a certain level of real coaching that you can get from a true professional executive coach that can give you that honest, you can be that level of honesty that you probably can't always all the time be for everyone else. And you get that expertise of them seeing, because they're pattern recognizers. They probably worked with many other founders like yourself. So they're able to use their pattern recognition and their expertise to provide the right insight or give you the right tools to think about the right problems and therefore create your own journey rather than just some other person's journey you heard on a podcast or read on a book. So absolutely recommend reading these things and listening to podcasts. I enjoy them a lot and I definitely learned a lot from them. But the more important part is really spending enough time to reflect. I think as doctors, we're trained on reflection. I genuinely value that a lot. Be a reflective founder that reflects, learns, journals, improves, actively works on their leadership skills every single day, and find a good executive coach to support you on that journey.
I was listening to a interview of Chamath Palihapitiya, and he was saying that he has, I think it's a mix of a therapist slash executive coach that he speaks to every single day. And I was just thinking, like, what the hell are you speaking to them about every day? Like, how much do you have to speak to them about? So I've heard this executive coach point made by a few people, and you've given a good case for it. But I was just wondering, is there any like anything you can point to that you felt like it changed the trajectory of what you were doing or kind of materially changed things? Like what like actual benefit has it brought into your practice?
So I think I view it as what the executive, my experience from executive coaching is a good executive coach should be able to give you the right, first of all, they should be able to challenge you. So I don't, it can be a spectrum from someone who's you know, on the very therapist end of things, where you can just offload and get some cathartic experience from just, you know, sharing what you're going through. And they probably will give you some ideas and feedback. And the other end of the spectrum, it becomes just very business oriented. You know, you should do this, you should do that. And I think different coaches have different styles and they sit on the spectrum. And I think most of the executive coaches I've worked with sit somewhere in the middle of the spectrum where you need to be able to get out of it that kind of little bit of like a bit of that therapy experience. You sit down, you kind of get your shoulders down, and you're like, maybe start with a sigh and like, yeah, here's another tough week. You know, I've got this and this going on and I'm worried about this and I'm scared about that. And I don't know how to deal with this issue and this is coming up and that's kind of worrying me. So it needs to be that because, again, like I said, some of the other stakeholders I mentioned earlier, whether it's you know, my wife or my co-founder or my investors, I don't think they would want me to sit down. They come to me for the answers. They're like, oh, you should have all the answers, right? So you can't. You need to have that kind of therapy relationship to a certain extent with the executive coach, where you can be yourself and be vulnerable and be able to say, I don't know what the hell I'm doing today, right? But also a more meaningful one where I found the real value is when they're able to, A, you know, give you the mental tools to think about things a certain way. So use certain frameworks of thinking. How do you prioritize things? How do you manage difficult conversations? How do you take a step back and put things in perspective? And they don't just do that for you. They give you the right tools, the right frameworks, the right, you know, concepts of ways of thinking. The other thing they really do well, a good example of coach I think can do, is talking to you about the the people challenges that most companies have. Because frankly, you know, 90%, I think, of what startups face or founders in startups face, 90% of the problems are related to intra-team problems. So, you know, your own team members, the C-suite, the senior leadership, how they're working, are they aligned, are they rolling in the right direction, how you manage the company's culture, how you manage difficult personalities or situations, how do you ensure that the message is communicated appropriately and aligned, and how are you driving the right outcomes from the right people, are you enabling them, are you being the right. Because as a CEO myself, I am actually the coach of the team as well. So as much as I'm being coached, my job is to coach them, to coach the people that report to me directly and work with me. So often, you know, you're working on these skills, these kind of leadership skills, the people management skills, the driving of the right outcomes and driving the right behaviors from teams. And I think this is the stuff where good executive coaches can help provide either the right tools, the right perspectives on how do you work with other people. And I think where I found value is in that. I found value in the therapeutic part of just being able to be open and vulnerable and get some feedback about how to put things in perspective. I found it valuable when they give you mental tools and frameworks to manage operational problems. And I also found it very valuable to be able to talk through the people management side of things, people working with other people, trying to get that, you know, to become a better leader, and a better coach of others. And I think, you know, I challenge most people, if you're going for an executive coaching, to make sure you get as much of those three domains as possible.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. You can find all my links by going to bigpicturemedicine.co.uk. And if you've been enjoying the podcast, then please consider leaving a review. By the way, all of these episodes are available in video format on YouTube and on Spotify. Thanks for listening.